Hi, everyone. Hello. I'm Marcia Henry, and I'm the interim director of the Center for Women, Peace, and Security here at LSE. I'm glad to see you all here for the event tonight. So the event's titled #Aid2, Where Do We Go From Here? We had quite a long selection of possible titles, very, very complicated, and then I thought, I think this is a nice open one, and hopefully we can get responses from the audience in the discussion to really inform where we go in relation to some of the issues that are going to be raised in the speaker's comments today. So I just want a few housekeeping things, if you can. If you can turn your phones onto silent, and just to let you know that we're not planning any kind of fire alarm or any other sort of warning system. So if there is a fire alarm, then of course we'll need to vacate the room and assemble outside outside the towers and around the corner. But anyway, there's not going to be a fire here tonight, so I don't want to alarm you. One of the reasons our first speaker is going to actually hint at some of the foundations of this event, but really, in the context of the sharp criticism of the UK aid sector for failing to tackle sexual abuse perpetrated by workers overseas, and in advance of a charity commission report and likely recommendations from the Department for International Development, this panel of practitioners and scholars will consider some broader questions. How do different sectors and disciplines understand the scope of the Aid2 movement? And can we, academics, practitioners, and policymakers, push for change inside organizations whilst also pursuing accountability? Could a broader perspective enable other interlocking forms of violence and abuse, such as racial and sexual harassment of LGBTQI and ethnic and racial minority aid workers within the aid sector, be addressed? So I'm really pleased to welcome Shaista Aziz, who's a former BBC, Al Jazeera, and CNN journalist and has worked as a communication specialist for organizations including Amnesty International, Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, and Oxfam. And she has worked extensively across the Middle East, Pakistan, East and West Africa. She is the founder of the Everyday Bigotry Project, an anti-racism, anti-bigotry digital platform, and co-founder of the Women's Advancement Hub, Pakistan, and really importantly, I think, for today and for you to all know, intersectional feminist foreign policy. We also have here Leslie Agams, who's a writer, lawyer, and social entrepreneur based in Abuja. She's literally just flown here for this event. She's founder of the Women's Crisis Center, Demeter's Solicitors and Advocates, Women's Legal Defense Trust Fund, NG Women for Peace, and NIJA by Nature. She has worked in social justice sector for over 25 years. And then we have Aiko Holvakivi, who's a researcher at the LSE Center for Women, Peace, and Security, and a PhD candidate at LSE's Department of Gender Studies, where she conducts research on gender training for military and police peacekeepers. And before entering academia, Aiko worked in the fields of international development and gender and security sector reform in the government and NGO sectors. Finally, we have Dr. Armini Ishkanian, who's an associate professor in the Department of Social Policy at LSE, and she is program director for the MSc in International Social and Public Policy and an associate member of LSE's International Inequalities Institute. And her research examines how civil society organizations and social movements engage in policy processes and transformative politics in a number of countries, including Armenia, Egypt, Greece, and the UK. So what we're going to do is have each speaker speak for about 10 minutes each, and then we'll turn over to questions and comments from the audience at the end. Okay? Great. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, good evening, everyone. Before I start, first of all, I just wanted to thank Marcia and Zoe and everybody else involved in organising this evening. We've come to the one-year anniversary of the Me Too movement, second time around, and there simply isn't enough discussion and space for us to have these conversations. So it's due to incredible academics and feminists such as Marsha that, you know, when you find women like that, you kind of, like, dig in. And, you know, so I just want to say thank you first and foremost there. And also to Alexia and to Louise, two fantastic and incredible women who we've been working together creating this platform called NGO Safe Space. And then finally, I just want to say the things that we're going to be discussing this evening are very can be very triggering, and I'm really aware of the fact that there will be people in this room who have their own experiences. And so let's just all be a little bit mindful of that as well. Let's have a good, respectful, honest discussion about things, because that's why we're here. But I just wanted to really acknowledge that I'm fully aware that there are people in the room who have experienced that. Okay, so in February this year, a news story broke, leading international news bulletins around the world, involving an international development organisation known to millions around the world and an institution in the UK that is part of the country's DNA, Oxfam. The Times splashed its investigation about Oxfam and the behaviour of a number of Western aid workers, or expats, who had been buying sex from local women. I'm doing this because I find this terminology very problematic. Local women is a code for poor, working class and vulnerable women of colour while they were in Haiti responding to the deadly and devastating earthquake in 2008. The story was picked up by news organisations around the world, and the story then led on to a number of other international humanitarian aid organisations having the spotlight put on them, and the story took a life of its own. Now, at the heart of the story is patriarchy, power, privilege, race, toxic masculinity, women, men, girls and boys, harmed and damaged by systems and structures and power that is overwhelmingly white, Western, male, and has its roots in the legacy of colonialism and neo-colonialism. Also at the heart of the story are the women whistleblowers, many of whom have paid a very heavy price with their careers put on hold or destroyed, some of whom have been painted as villains in the story for bravely speaking out to protect vulnerable people and to instigate change. I know those women, and I know those men too. The way the story was framed, however, by many seeking to only look inward during this so-called scandal, was that the reporting was a right-wing orchestrated attack on the aid sector, and that the UK government, hostile in its attitude towards international development, and the previously ring-fenced international aid budget, was using the Oxfam scandal as an excuse to cut funding for the development and aid sector. More on that later. But for now, back to the women. Who are the women at the heart of the story? They're white European women working in international headquarters for development and humanitarian organisations. They're women of colour, fewer in number and so more easily identifiable, working in the same settings and headquarters and in the field. And they include those women who are referred to in the sector as beneficiaries. Through this label alone, their agency is immediately removed and the power structures that are imposed on them laid bare for anyone who really wants to see and understand what is going on. So in 2007, I was sent to Haiti while I was employed by Oxfam to interview women across the country about their experiences of climate change and how their lives were being impacted by so-called natural disasters. The women I met were amongst the most economically and socially disenfranchised women in the world, and this was before the 2008 earthquake. They were dark-skinned Haitian women, poor, working class, and they had nothing. Now, these women are very open and very candid with me. We had lots of conversations about what it means to be a woman in one of the poorest countries in the world, a country where I saw women and men's entire persona and body language change when UN peacekeepers were around. Haiti, like many parts of the world humanitarians work in, has a long and devastating history with colonialism. As I travelled across Haiti, I didn't meet a single woman whose priority it was to barter for sex with foreign aid workers. This is the type of terminology that's been used by journalists and by others. I did, however, see up close and personal the NGO cultures involving lighter-skinned Haitian women being ferried around in white Land Cruisers and taken to fancy restaurants and parties. I'm a former Oxfam Save the Children and MSF employee, and I've spent more than 15 years working as a communication specialist with aid organisations and worked in contexts such as Haiti, Liberia, Ethiopia, Somaliland, Nigeria, Pakistan, Syria, Palestine, in Yemen, with vulnerable communities, girls and women, in the immediate aftermath of natural disasters during war and conflict, as mass displacement of civilians is taking place. I've worked with refugees and women living on top of rubbish dumps in Iraq as they fled for their lives with their clothes on their back and their children under their arms. Now, over the years, I've met many, many women who have told me about how they were asked to trade their bodies for aid and told to provide oral sex and full-blown sex if they wanted to ensure their children received food and access to water. So we all know these stories exist in the humanitarian sector, and they've existed for decades and decades. So what made this year's Oxfam stories and Save the Children stories and MSF stories and UN stories so different? Why is it that 8 months on from the reporting on Oxfam that women and men who've suffered sexual abuse and sexual harassment in the aid sector are still scrambling around seeking accountability and redress? And why are victims and survivors still overwhelmingly unwilling or unable to report cases to their employers via their internal systems? Why are victims and survivors dependent on crowdsourcing and fundraising campaigns to seek legal advice on how they can pursue a pathway to making their former or current employers take their complaints of sexual assault, abuse and harassment seriously? These are some of the issues I'm here to talk about. So earlier this year, Me Too exploded on the scene, second time around. Aid 2, Church 2, Mosque 2, Time's Up, We Believe Her, Why I Didn't Report, all followed. A global movement has started and it's not going to stop. It's a global movement of solidarity, a global movement of quiet, controlled and loud and visible rage, a global movement seeking redress, and a global movement seeking justice. A global movement placing an inclusive, representative feminism, and a global movement that increasingly understands intersectionality, and the real feminism is intersectional and rooted in challenging systems of oppression, which victimize women in specific and particular ways based on their identities. As a woman with intersectional identities, my experience of sexual harassment, racism, Islamophobia and sexism in the aid sector were unique to me in the headquarters I worked in. I was almost always the only woman who looked like me working in those headquarters. And to many in my own country, the UK, I look foreign. So I looked foreign to a lot of the people that I worked with as well. And I think this is really important because in amongst all the reporting so far, there's not been enough emphasis on the issues around intersectionality, and there's been very limited reporting from women of colour. And when you speak to women of colour, as we have been through our platform NGO Safe Space, they tell you very clearly that they will not be reporting the abuse because they're easily identifiable. I'm talking specifically about women working in headquarters, but also in the so-called field. This is very, very problematic. So my point here is that we haven't, you know, in terms of the tip of the iceberg, we're nowhere near. And also, as a journalist and a storyteller, I do believe that the way the Aid 2 movement so far has been framed is very much like Me Too. It's all about anecdotal cases. You know, this happened to her, that happened to him, he did that to her, she did that to him. There's no real desire to actually really focus on the what's at the heart of this, which is patriarchy and power, or power and patriarchy. You pick which way you want to go first, right? It reinforces each other. And also right at the center of this is race. When it comes to gender and the treatment towards women, without a shadow of a doubt, you cannot take away class or race. And it's not being discussed enough, and it's certainly not being discussed in the media coverage, because I think it's a bit too complex for some people to be able to discuss that. So I'm just going to use the rest of my limited time just to talk you through why we set up NGO Safe Space. So these two fantastic sisters at the front here, we came together because we were very aware that we'd all been working in the aid sector and we'd all had different experiences and we'd been hearing from other women, and we knew that women were terrified, and I do use that word on purpose, they are terrified. Journalists have come up to me and said, why won't the women talk? They are shocked by the fact that there is so much silencing in the aid sector. I'm not using these words to be dramatic, I'm using them because I believe they're absolutely accurate words. So I had a meeting with a senior producer working in a big international news organisation here in the UK, in London in fact, this was about 6 months ago, and this producer said in all her time of working as an investigative journalist, she had never known silencing like this. And one of the reasons for this is because the aid sector is full of men, let's be clear about that, it's full of women too, but men who have a lot of power. And there's a revolving door between aid and the world of politics and the world of media. So if these three worlds, they reinforce each other, and these power structures and the patriarchy reinforces each other. And we've seen through the cases of Oxfam and others that there has been a revolving door between power. And so if these organizations are serious about really, really getting to grips with what's going on, they have to first look at the power structures inside the organisations. There's also an attempt to suggest that all of this, if it's seen through the lens of safeguarding, will fix everything. Safeguarding is very, very important. It's vital. It needs to be there, but it will not fix everything because this is not about safeguarding. This goes beyond safeguarding. Okay, so very briefly, we pulled together an anonymized survey. We sent it out. We put it out on a web portal. We had more than 100 responses in the first week. In 2 weeks, we had almost 200 responses. This is three women and a laptop. Okay? If we can do this, then I'd like to know why other institutions whose job it is to do this haven't done this even yet. So we asked a number of questions. Who can be susceptible to sexual violence? Guess what? Anyone. Especially young women who are starting off in their careers. And when it comes to men, if they are gay men and they are predominantly in environments where it's heavily full of women, they also can be prone to extreme bullying and extreme harassment as well. And now our evidence has gone to two parliamentary inquiries. One is the inquiry set up to look at sexual harassment in the workplace. The second one is the International Development Committee. And we've been told that DFID are also keen to look at our data and information for their forthcoming conference on safeguarding, which is on Thursday. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up just by reading to you a couple of quotes from anonymized individuals that came forward. So basically, we had testimony. A large proportion of the reported experiences of sexual harassment were of inappropriate language. This is UK aid agencies, by the way, including unwanted advances and suggestive comments of a sexual nature. Women also reported more serious offences such as inappropriate touching, sexual assault and rape. And what we found was women were very reluctant to use the term rape. In one conversation I had with a woman, she described in great detail what happened to her. And then I gently asked her, would you say this is rape? And she took a good few minutes to respond and said, I've never wanted to describe it as that, but that's what it was. Right, so quick few quotes from our survey. I have definitely experienced cases of sexist and ambiguous remarks and jokes at the workplace, but often not directed specifically to me, but just accepted in general. Again, this is about the culture in organisations, right? I was sexually harassed by a very senior director, verged on stalker behaviour, barrage of emails, texts, requests, sometimes via his PA, to come into his office for a little chat. I was directly told not to mention our chats to other people, as they wouldn't understand. Another quote. In the most recent situation, I was harassed by a male worker who was under my direct supervision. He first made personal advances, inviting me for dinners, drinks, and sending me texts with obvious intent to have sex with me. Other colleagues, men and women, repeatedly hinted that he had interest in me. I felt like it was an attempt to normalise these types of advances towards me. Final quote I'm going to read out. I've had a man try to lock me in his office to rape me so I could get a UN job. So these are some of the responses. I do have copies of this report with me, and they're also up on our website. And yeah, we've got some recommendations. The first one is lead by example. Who would have thought? And then there's various other ones. I mean, there's plenty of rules and regulations out there and guidelines, but if they're not going to be reinforced, then there's no point having them. So I just think we need to be really aware that when we keep hearing this term safeguarding, which is absolutely needed, but we need to unpick what does safeguarding mean. And there are many feminists working in this sector who need to be heard. The solutions to solve some of these cultural and behavioural issues, i.e. patriarchy, are already inside these organisations. And they need to start listening to those feminists who've been doing this work for a very long time. Thank you very much.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for inviting me and giving me this opportunity to be heard. I've had an incredible amount of support in the wake of in the past year since Me Too has the second wave of Me Too. And I was telling Shaista a little bit earlier as we were walking down how important that has been for me. Because in 2010, when I had my experience, there wasn't that kind of coming together. And I remember one of the things I felt most was this feeling of loneliness and of really, really isolation. And it's really good to have that groundswell that has happened. It's unfortunate how it happened in the wake of Weinstein, but it's really important. And I'd like to thank everybody who's been so supportive, Alexia Shaista, and everybody else who's here, those known and unknown. We're here to ask, where do we go from here? Like Zoe said, I'm a writer, I'm a lawyer, and I'm a social entrepreneur. And I want us to look, where are we at the moment? Right now, we have a DFID summit that's coming up. We have an Oxfam independent commission that's working on a report. Save the Children have written a report. Charity Commission has written a report. Code Blue is focusing on UN reforms at the UN. I'm not going to go into the details of my experience, because I think that's so much in the past that it's really not relevant. But I do want to pick out some of the key issues from my personal story and how I think it feeds into the broader considerations that we're making here tonight. When I was attacked in 2010. The first person I went to 2 days after the attack, after I heard that such a person was Martin Knops. He was the in-house counselor at Oxfam at the time. And I was in Oxford for an orientation and induction, and I just found out that he was available to provide psychological support for any of the staff who needed it. So after my attack, I went to him. I didn't go to him because I wanted anything to happen to Samuel Musa, who attacked me, who was my line manager. I wasn't looking to punish him. I wasn't looking to have him to ruin his life or to have him lose his job. I went to Martin Knops at the time. I went looking for help for the shock and the emotional distress that the attack had caused me. I was thinking of me at that time. I joke about it now that somebody should have called an ambulance instead of advising me to call the police, because that's what I needed. I needed first aid. I didn't get it then, and not even when I asked for it, and I haven't gotten it since. Helen Lewis, who is the deputy editor of the New Statesman, I'm sure most of you must have read her article that came out last week. Was it last week? Yes, last week, marking the 1 year of Me Too. And she wrote that, like me, many of the women she's spoken to were not looking to see their abusers punished or even shamed. She said that most of them told her that they wanted acknowledgement and maybe an apology. Perhaps they wanted an acknowledgement of the injury they had suffered. I know I wanted more than just an apology and an acknowledgement. I wanted treatment. I went to Martin Knops for treatment. He referred me to HR. HR made a mess of my case. And I asked again in 2013. I also wrote then, I was already ex-Oxfam after they had dismissed me, and I asked again, I asked for support with treatment, because by then it had become obvious to me that I was suffering significant effects from the violent attack that I experienced. And I like to tell people, I don't call it sexual harassment. It's difficult for me to say I was sexually harassed. I wasn't. I was sexually assaulted by a man who had, previous to that night, never expressed any sort of sexual interest or flirtation with me, which also meant that I was not on my guard. If you have a coworker who's handsy or who is maybe a little bit too flirtatious or says inappropriate things, as women, and we're all women, we all know how we treat those coworkers. The last thing you do with that coworker is go to his hotel room when he says, come see a document. Am I right or wrong? But because that had never come up, I didn't expect it. The attack and the subsequent dismissal were, for me, life-changing events. I'm not the same person that I was. I had written several paragraphs to describe how I've changed. I think the most interesting thing that I'd like to share is that, well, all of a sudden, or part of the change that I've become is that I'm now queer. I'm no longer a woman. And I choose that very deliberately because I figured that if being a woman doesn't get me good treatment, then maybe I'll just try being a person. And since we're in that time, in that era, where we can, where we're discussing what gender means, I've decided that I'm queer and that I will no longer be a woman. I also read that somewhere, actually in two different articles I read, that it's also part of the traumatic outcomes from attacks. So it could be that too. But like I said, I don't want to talk too much about me or what happened to me. I do want to, however, say that I'm completely surprised about the lack of response, especially here in the UK, to the growing number of accusations. I read in Helen Lewis's article that there are over 664,000 reports of sexual assault in the UK last year. The Charity Commission themselves, in March of this year, when they were writing up in the wake of the Haiti scandal, said that they received over 1,000 reports from various charities about sexual assault in the previous year. And I'm thinking to myself that if even just a small percentage of the women who were assaulted have experienced what I've experienced in the past 8 years, we have a serious mental health crisis brewing within the AIDS sector. And that's before you even consider the fact that the humanitarian work many of us do is itself also traumatic when you're in the field dealing with trauma. There have been studies that have established the health effects, so it's not new. As feminists, it was feminist scholars who developed the literature and for decades now have provided the language and the theory and the frameworks with which sexual assault and sexual violence has become a cash cow for the entire AIDS sector. The Oxfams and the Save the Children and all the other big organizations, they raise most of their money when they claim that they want to help poor colored people somewhere in the developing world, especially women. And it was feminists who gave them that language. And yet, at the same time, these women are not the ones making the decision. These theories have been appropriated, have been taken, and I think the statistics are that out of total development aid, less than 0.01% actually goes to women and women-led organizations. I don't think it's enough what DFID, the Charity Commission, Oxfam, and Save the Children are doing with their safeguarding. I don't think their publishing of reports how to prevent sexual exploitation and abuse or how to punish abusers is enough. I would like to see commitments. I would like to see them make commitments to provide mandatory psychotherapeutic support and legal support also to everyone who experiences SEA on the job. I think the hysteria around sex has obfuscated the fact that sexual harassment is a labor rights issue as well as a human rights issue. I think the IDC report was wrong when it said that currently, when organizations fail to hold abusers to account, the victims and survivors have no other course to recourse to justice. They continue to have recourse to justice in the courts of law. The question is, why aren't they taking advantage of those laws? Are they aware of the legal and the social reliefs that are available to them? And whose responsibility is it to inform them of those rights? What challenges do they face when they're trying to exercise those rights? What are the institutional, legal, or social obstacles that survivors face when reporting and seeking support? The IDC report, however, was right when they said that self-regulation has failed. My question is, how did the sector become self-regulating? Where are the legal exemptions? The UN is the only humanitarian organization, if we can call them that, that actually has legal immunity. And according to them, if they are to be believed, they have now waived such immunity in cases of sexual exploitation and abuse. So I've been asking and I've been researching for the past few weeks as I've recovered from my latest, experience post-Haiti, because that triggered me badly enough to make me sick. And as I've recovered, I did a lot of research. And these questions come up to me. Also in this article by Helen Lewis, there was a suggestion that the problem isn't that legal safeguards don't exist. They suggested that the employers don't understand the laws. I reject this. This is not true. Kemp and Merkelbach wrote a report in 2010. Can you be sued? And they very clearly outlined the legal liability of organizations where it comes to personal injury. And they gave very clear they gave a very clear picture of jurisdictions in the UK, the US, in France, in Italy. They focused on the global north. However, my research has also shown, for instance, that there are also very progressive protections in South Africa, which is also developing a very impressive amount of case law, and even in my own country, Nigeria. Unfortunately, the Nigerian Industrial Court wasn't established till 2011, which was after my assault, and I didn't take advantage of it at that time. And it wasn't until last year that they changed the court rules and now made sexual harassment a human rights issue and holding employers liable, not for employment issues, but as a human rights issue. So the laws are there, and they're not being taken advantage of. I believe the employers know this. It's the employees who I think do not know about these laws. And I think it's the employees who need to know about these laws and who need to be told about these laws. When DFID invited me for the summit on Thursday, for the safeguarding summit on Thursday, and I think their invitation, I assumed at the time that their invitation stemmed from my research, which I had published on my blog and made public. And I also felt that the legal questions were so broad that it's not something I could address alone. So I suggested to DFID that we make the legal aspects of this, of safeguarding, a thematic session during the summit, where we can call legal experts, legal advisors, including, for instance, I suggested Terrence Donovan of Kingsley Napley. I think it's a very big legal firm here in London, because he went on record to say, and it's still on their site, that any employee who has experienced sexual abuse or harassment in the workplace does have a claim against any charity, and it would be a personal injury claim. He was very clear with that, which also supported what Kemp and Merkelbach said. And I actually wrote to them. I wrote to Terrence Donovan, and I'm like, well, since you said me, apparently I'm out of time because there's a statute of limitation for you to bring a personal injury claim, which, but for those who haven't, why are they not taking advantage? Why are they sitting, hiding their pain and not taking advantage of the legal protections that exist already? This isn't something that we need to do. This isn't advocacy that we need to do, whether it's for legislation or for new policies. These exist. I think as women, as feminists, as activists, and as citizens, we need to know about our rights and the laws that will protect them. And we need to start using those laws. Janice Turner, who is also quoted in the article that I mentioned, asked whether our silence about sexual assault made us complicit. I don't think our silence does, but I think our inaction does, especially where we have laws that we can use. DFID should make a feminist analysis of sexual harassment laws in all the recipient countries, and should make it a requirement for any aid agency seeking public funds in the UK. This is my opinion. While I appreciate, and if local laws are found to be inadequate, I think they should waive the jurisdictional clauses that they put in all national contracts. However, Kemp and Merkelbach have also already said, argued that jurisdictional clauses may actually be illegal and may not be upheld, enforceable anyway. I don't think we need to continue with appeals to a higher consciousness. I think we need to take action, and I think we can take legal action. And while DFID has said that we cannot have that legal forum and discuss these legal issues, I think that perhaps as a community we could still do that and call the kind of expertise that can give us a better and a broader perspective. Because right now, all of these agencies, including DFID, they spend more on legal fees and PR than they're spending on safeguarding. And the people who've experienced SEA, I think they require and they deserve at least as good as legal representation, if not better than that. Thank you.
Okay, good evening, everyone, and thank you for coming to our discussion. And thank you to Shaista and Leslie for being so generous in sharing your experience and giving such powerful interventions. It's not an easy one to follow. But to situate my comments a little bit, so the place that I'm speaking from is that I'm currently conducting research on gender training for peacekeepers. And within that, I'm also looking at sexual exploitation and abuse in peacekeeping missions involving primarily military peacekeepers. But before I undertook this research, I worked for a number of years in an international non-governmental organization in the kind of development security sector reform field, and I was based in Switzerland, in Geneva. So not really UK aid sector, but my comments are in many ways looking at the discussion around aid to both from the point of view of academic research as well as some personal experiences and exchanges. And from that vantage point, one of the things that strikes me in the discussion around aid too, and especially in contrast to how UN peacekeeping is talked about, is how this discussion focuses on different forms of sexual exploitation, abuse, harassment, violence. So, for example, some actors looking, for example, at the DevEx online discussion last year about hashtag aid too, or the report published by the Feinstein International Center. So these focus on sexual harassment and assault within organizations, so sexual misconduct directed at colleagues. And on the other hand, the aid to discussion has encompassed cases involving misconduct against the beneficiaries of aid, or the intended beneficiaries of aid, I should say, that is the host population in the area of intervention, as has become typified by the Oxfam case, which has attracted so much media and policy attention this year. So in other words, peacekeeping discussions tend to insist on separating out forms of violence. They tend to insist on separating out internal sexual harassment, sexual exploitation and abuse against host populations, and conflict-related sexual violence in war spaces as kind of separate phenomena. But what seems to be at stake in the aid to movement is talking about various forms of sexual misconduct that are committed by those working in the aid sector. And it does so in ways that allows us to track patterns and draw connections between these different types of violences. Looking at the recent discussion, something that caught my attention in the conversation is the seeming ease with which some actors seem to fall back on a kind of bad apples theory of sexual misconduct. For example, in February at a parliamentary committee hearing, the leadership of Save the Children warned that predatory men were seeking to use aid work as an opportunity for abuse. To quote them, they said, "There is no doubt that there are people with a sexual interest in children who actively seek out the opportunity to work with children." In other words, they were suggesting that misconduct happens because of bad individuals. And I think there's a slight problem with this explanation, right? That it assumes that there's a fixed number of predators in the population, and if only they could be accurately identified and kept out through proper vetting processes, then that wouldn't be a problem. And this type of reasoning has been, of course, discredited by much of feminist research, which, first of all, points out the normatively problematic conclusions to which it leads, as well as for the fact that it fails to account for different levels of sexual misconduct and violence in different organizations in different places, right? So accordingly, I think it's a worthwhile question to ask not just what can be done to identify and pick out the bad apples, but rather, is there something in the aid industry more broadly that enables sexual misconduct? And in this vein, I'd like to offer a couple of reflections on institutional cultures and structures. So first, on the question of institutional culture, some of the research, especially around sexual harassment within the aid industry, such as this report drafted by Mazurana and Donnelly for the Feinstein International Center, identifies as a problem male dominance of these institutions and a macho culture. And I think we can extend this thinking about the maleness of the culture to also consider its whiteness, as many women of color who work in the field have invited us to do. And kind of attuned to the maleness of whiteness of some of these spaces helps us identify how in some environments in which development and humanitarian work take place, there's a discourse that creates a mental image of the development space, of the field, as a kind of exceptional space where different modes of behavior are expected and different rules apply. There appears to be, in many aid spaces, an understanding that the field is a place where aid workers are expected to party hard, to drink excessively, and to engage in lots of sex. And this image of the field is produced by many different actors, including, for example, doctors telling patients who are about to deploy to the field that they expect them to come back with lots of sexually transmitted diseases. So it's not just the men at the top, but there's a kind of discourse which I suggest leads to the fact that the field becomes a kind of zone of exception where different rules apply. And in looking at this construction, it becomes really hard to ignore the historical resonances of how stays overseas from the global north, from colonial administrations to military bases, to foreign military bases, have been associated, in Anne McClintock's words, with the long tradition of male travel as an erotics of ravishment. So looking at the types of ways in which the development space is talked about and thought about suggests that this might also constitute an enabling factor for the types of misconduct that have come to light. And this is in line with Mazzarana and Donnelly's analysis, which posits that the tolerance for sexual banter and crude jokes in the workplace is associated with increased levels of harassment and violence. Incidentally, similar research has come out of the U.S. military, suggesting that units in which misogynistic and homophobic language is tolerated also have higher incidence of sexual harassment and assault. And so kind of thinking back to the historical continuities of this imagery, we could imagine that casual racism, such as the often heard refrain of "This is Africa," to explain all manner of failure and incompetence as a kind of shorthand, enables a racializing mode of thinking that facilitates seeing the beneficiaries of aid as somehow less competent and ultimately as less human. So all this is to suggest that perhaps what is needed is an intervention in institutional cultures that facilitates an understanding of the field as an exotic location of adventure and that tolerate casual sexism, racism, and homophobia. Which brings me to the question of institutional cultures, institutional structures, because that's where another challenge to intervening in these kind of cultures lies. In the cases of sexual harassment and assault that have come to light in the context of the A2 movement, it's become clear that staff often face heavy repercussions for reporting harassment and assault, right? People like Shasta have documented instances of being dismissed, being fired, and so on. And the same power structure also acts as a disincentive to intervene in kind of the more enabling cultural questions, right? It's often highlighted that aid work is characterized by vast pay differentials between international staff and national staff. And further, I think it's worth bearing in mind that in some organizations, probably especially the UN, many of the international staff, while enjoying higher rates of pay, are often also very precariously employed. Many of them work 6 or 12 month contracts and are constantly looking for their next job. And I would suggest that this kind of precarity also significantly raises the barrier on what types of behaviors individuals are willing or able to speak out against. And I would suggest that it may incentivize letting a sexually charged joke or a casually racist comment slide because it might not be seen as something important enough to jeopardize your livelihood for. So in other words, what I just wanted to get at with this is that institutional power structures make it very difficult to intervene in the culture. So I think I'm going to conclude there by just noting that what I think the discussion around A2 has demonstrated by bringing to light cases of harassment and assault is that sexual misconduct, from where I'm looking, seems to not only be a military problem, nor can it be isolated to a few bad individuals. It suggests that we can't rely on this bad apples logic, and it prompts us to ask questions about the broader institutional cultures and structures these behaviors are embedded in. And I do wonder whether we should think about the bad apples analogy as applying to individual organizations as well. Because the fact that this behavior becomes known in one organization doesn't necessarily mean that it's worse than the others. Furthermore, and counterintuitively, in some instances where these kinds of behaviors come to light, may be an indicator that there's something being done to address it. And so I think we should bear in mind this context when responding to individual cases of abuse when they surface. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marcia, for inviting me. And I'm happy to be here. And it's very difficult to speak after all of these wonderful presentations. What I will try to do is to bring this together in terms of looking at institutions within the aid sector, specifically thinking about NGOs, non-governmental organizations, as actors, but also thinking about them within the context of other stakeholders. And when I think about NGOs, I think about when NGOs became prominent in aid, because that wasn't always the case in the context of development. NGOs became prominent in the late 1980s, and especially in the 1990s. And at that time, they were often described as the magic bullet solutions. They were seen as the darlings of development. And yet, 30 years onwards, we see them as suspect characters. And suspicion comes from different sources, which I'll mention in a minute. But I think what perhaps bothers most people with NGOs when we see bad behavior is that we look to NGOs, or at least we did at some point, as moral actors, as actors that were charged with bringing about positive, progressive changes in society, about introducing better norms of behavior. So when we see these quote-unquote bad behaviors, we are bothered by the hypocrisy of NGOs. So I think it's important to think about NGOs in a very critical manner and to think about them as institutions that perhaps shouldn't be, you know, that we should question what NGOs are for and why are they around. Because in recent years, what we've seen is that the trust in NGOs is declining from many places. The public trust in many countries, including in the UK, has fallen because not only of the sex scandals or all of these, you know, issues that have been mentioned already today, but because of financial misuse or financial misconduct by NGOs, by the six-figure salaries of NGO executives in this country. So public trust is declining. States, not just in perhaps authoritarian states, but across the world, we see governments enacting anti-NGO laws or more oppressive laws because NGOs are seen as subversive characters or fifth columns in some places. Private companies question NGOs. Obviously, they have their own agenda, but they question the probity of NGOs or the ability of NGOs to actually act in a competent manner. And last but not least, and this is drawing on my own research in the post-2010 movements from very different countries around austerity but also for democracy, social movements and grassroots activists also question NGOs. They criticize NGOs for being corporate sellouts and for being co-opted actors. So given this wider dynamic, NGOs are under attack from many sources. And now if we bring the Me Too, Aid Too movement, you can see that it's a very difficult environment in which they are operating. But I think that we can see that as a glass half empty or half full, and perhaps there's an opportunity to rejuvenate the sector and to really ask important questions about how do we go forward from here and to think about what is the purpose of NGOs in the context of development and humanitarian aid. So my next question or area that I want to think about is about NGO accountability, which has already been hinted at. In the literature on NGOs, we talk about upward or downward accountability. When we talk about upward accountability, it's generally to, you know, the way that it's presented in the literature, it's about upward accountability to donors, to states, to governments, and then downward accountability to their own staff or to their beneficiaries. Now, obviously, this indicates hierarchies and power. Now, when we talk about power, we assume that the donors have power over NGOs, and certainly they do in the sense that they hold the purse strings. But have donors in the context that we're talking about today exercise that power responsibly? Why have they not necessarily acted in the manner in which they could act? Because when there is financial misconduct by NGOs, they yank the funding. But have they necessarily been quick to act to implement? So I think this is something we need to think about. And alongside talking about accountability, we need to talk about responsibility. Whose responsibility is it to protect? And obviously, we've discussed about institutional cultures, and I agree with a lot of what Aiko has said about norms and institutional cultures and structures. And I think there, it's about what exists, but also who has the power to exercise it and to implement it and to make sure things are happening. And oftentimes, when we look at NGOs and their reluctance to act or their reluctance to face up to some of these uncomfortable truths, it's because of their fear of what reputational damage it will have. Because that is one of the most precious things to NGOs, as indeed to others. It's that reputation. In Armenian, we have a proverb, we say, it's better to lose your eye than to lose your reputation. Sounds pretty horrific, but I think what it indicates is that if you lose your eye, at least you can continue. But if you lose your reputation, much is lost. So I think here, there are several reasons why NGOs are reluctant to act. One is obviously the reputational damage that can lead to funding losses, to their loss in terms of having a place at the policy table. And, you know, we can see these as real kind of dangers in the perspective of NGOs. But at the same time, we need to think between short-term and long-term. Will an NGO be treated better by the public that faces up to its difficulties and tries to change in a positive direction, or one that tries to hide it and brush these uncomfortable truths and problems under the rug? So I think this is a discussion we need to have. So the question is, where should change come from? And I've mentioned the donors, I've mentioned other actors, but I think we need to look to all of us as we are potential donors in terms of being members of organizations or contributors. So I think the public can play a very big role, as can indeed the press, as can indeed governments and institutions. So I think it needs to be thought about more widely. And to conclude, I want to talk a little bit about intersectionality in the context of civil society organizations and social movements. And this is drawing on my recent research with a UK feminist, intersectional feminist group called Sisters on Cut, which some of you may have heard of. And this is a research that I co-produced with a colleague of mine, Anita Peña Saavedra. And we were thinking about, how does intersectionality, which is a political idea, it's a concept, get translated into a political and social movement strategy? And it's very important to think about this, because we can say, I want to be intersectional, but how do you actually put intersectionality into practice is a big question. And so looking at the practices, what we found is that there were three key elements. The first being a culture of intersectionality. It's a respected norm. It is a commitment to being a particular way, to being self-reflexive. But a commitment is not enough. You need the toolkit. You need the mechanisms. So, for instance, safer spaces, but also reflective spaces and actual, you know, ways in which dialogue is mediated. And, of course, finally, it is about not just thinking about the organization, but also thinking about ourselves as individual actors, about reflecting on our own privileges, about our own positionality, and being able to have the uncomfortable conversations, because none of us likes to be called out for our privilege, but I think it's important to be open to that and to reflect on, where are we coming from? How are we acting towards others? And I think, you know, it's very important to do this, because in many ways we see these power is, you know, it's not just a male thing or a female thing. Power exists in many places, and it's about thinking about where power comes from and how power can be challenged. And I was surprised when we were doing this research to find that many so-called feminist NGOs were very keen on silencing their own employees and who were acting as activists. I'll give you one example. One of the Sisters on Cut activists that we interviewed had been formally disciplined by her employer, which is a feminist NGO in this country, because they had not only attended a demonstration, but they had also tweeted about it. And the organization's HR manager called her into the office and said, this is very dangerous, because if, you know, our funders see this, they might cut our funding. So silencing happens in many different forms and places, and I think we need to keep an open mind. And on that, I'd also like to say, you know, it is very important that we're talking about women and the violence that's perpetrated against women. But from my research in the past in Greece, especially in the camps and in Lesbos, what we found was that it's not just about women being abused, but also about boys and young men, and we should not forget them. And in some instances, often it's perpetrated by men with power, but in some of these instances, we were hearing stories about how women were also abusing their power. So I think we need to always maintain a critical perspective and think about what's happening and ask questions and hold power to account. Thank you.
Wow. What a panel. Fantastic. I'm so glad that I didn't prepare anything for this panel. I didn't put myself onto it because that's been a pretty amazing and comprehensive, I think, discussion, opening up so many avenues for conversation. So I want to open it up for discussion opportunities from the audience. You getting the mic?
Is there one there?
Is that it?
I have one, yes, thank you.
So we think about two down there and then over there. Yeah, okay. That order's fine too.
Hi, thank you. My question is actually for all the panelists. I notice in talks like this and articles around the A2 movement that there's a very, very strong focus on the NGO sector. For understandable reasons, it's often the most public face of the delivery of aid. But when aid in the UK, aid funded by DFID, is predominantly delivered by private sector organisations delivering aid, why are we not having a conversation about the private sector organisations delivering aid? Why are they not included in this? I understand that actually a huge amount of what we talk about and deal with when we say NGOs, we use it as a catchphrase to mean all actors delivering aid. But the reason I think I'm very concerned that they're not included a lot in the scrutiny and the conversations and the issues is because they don't sit under the same legal frameworks. There's no charity commission looking at private sector actors delivering aid. That's very problematic. And DFID deals with, acts with, and communicates with, and has different relationships with these actors in extremely different ways from the NGOs. And accountability-wise, the upward accountability towards DFID and other donors is very different for the private sector actors. So it's a great concern of mine that we're not making this part of the conversation when so much of aid is delivered through these actors. So I'd be really interested to hear the panel's thoughts. And thank you so much for your presentations.
Okay, we'll just gather a few questions and then give you an opportunity to pose it.
So I guess my question is sort of primarily for Aiko, but if the other panelists have thoughts, I'd be really interested. So I'm coming from the perspective that I'm a humanitarian aid worker, and I've worked for a number of different NGOs in the UN. And in my experience, when we've been doing SEA work, is it's one thing to sort of advocate on an individual level or in an individual organization for funding for safeguarding and for prevention. So the basic training to have enough, to have, you know, people understand what kind of behavior is accepted and not. And then it's quite another to address some of the things that you were talking about in terms of institutional culture and institutional structures, which I very much do agree in my own experience are massively feeding into it. But I guess my question to you and to the rest of the panelists is, how do you, like on a practical level, how do we address that? How, not just in an individual organization, but in the aid sector in general, and that's encompassing like both NGOs and the UN, and as my colleague over there has just pointed out, the private sector, because this is a lot of like, in my experience, and maybe there are better organizations or better responses out there that I haven't been to, but the knowledge of power, privilege, and gender dynamics, like in the field, much less in headquarters, is very, very low. So how do we address that? Because that's the root of it, isn't it?
So I am rather coming from a personal experience perspective, and it was very I would say spine-chilling, but at the same time empowering to listen to particularly Leslie and other stories as well. With sexual harassment or sexual offences, even if you mention laws, my question is, when are women believed or not believed? Secondly, going through some legal institutions like the police and the court systems, from my cultural perspective, when you said that a lady was describing what happened to her, but she wasn't willing to say rape, that was something similar to me as well. And the police ended up rather blaming me, attacking me constantly. And later on, they did admit, yeah, we considered her reports to be malicious, discounting all the facts, the psychological trauma that such an instance can bring on someone. But on the other hand, the court and the proceedings as well, this gives power to the offenders further, because the victim is not just blamed, is psychologically traumatized, even if they decide to come forward. And on top of that, the evidence threshold required in the criminal justice system feeds to the problem rather than stop or curtail the problem. So I am saying from my personal experience that I am completely puzzled and lost, because my expectations were, in a society where there are institutions, one would not expect that. Because the West is very staunchly critical of countries like, I come from Pakistan, that there are no institutions there and the institutions don't function. But dealing with the police, dealing with the criminal justice system, and still trying to persevere is only re-traumatizing me as an individual. And rather, on top of that, because there are some laws in this country which are easier to prove, sexual offenses are harder to prove. So the perpetrator, when his report goes to the police, he in turn goes to the police and says, this person is harassing me and causing a loss of my reputation. So I am coming from a position where I think, like most other women, the wisdom should have been to remain quiet, wait for the next perpetrator, wait for the next victim. Even when I decided to come forward, with the risks that it entails, the social risks that it entails for me as an individual, this is where I found the weaknesses in the system. And how do the panelists or even other people, I'm exposing myself because I want people to think and solve a problem rather than let the problem perpetrate. Letting aside you speaking of countries where there will be a lack of institutional integrity, where there will be lack of structures and systems. But in a country like the UK, where they pride themselves to be the best democracy in the world, this is happening. Thank you.
Shall we? You want to take some more questions?
No.
You want to take some of the questions?
Yeah, someone else has
asked. Yeah, why don't you start?
Okay, thank you so much for your questions, but especially to the sister who just spoke. Thank you so much for sharing that. I was asked by the International Development Committee if I wanted to give evidence, and I declined based on the fact that I asked them what kind of sympathy would a woman in a hijab who is of Pakistani heritage get in the current climate. When I say current climate, the ongoing climate. And they really didn't have anything to say to me. Just to be very clear, I was not sexually assaulted. I've been sexually harassed. I've been treated every single organization I've worked for. I have become a victim of Islamophobia and racism and sexism and in some cases misogyny and sexual harassment. So I had to make a calculated decision and say to that inquiry, what you know, what sympathy, what empathy am I going to get? And I said the same thing to another very high profile MP, and she really did not know what to say to me. So these are the realities that we face as women. This term intersectionality has become very fashionable. It's been thrown around left, right and centre. Very few people understand it. Those of us who live it understand it. So I fully salute you for what you've just said, and I'd love to talk to you separate of this, but thank you so much for raising that. I know how I have an understanding of how difficult it was for you to speak, so thank you. But, you know, when I mentioned the fact that there is a lack of women of colour coming forward to report the abuse that they are going through, it's because of all these factors and more. The system is broken, but it's especially broken if you happen to be a woman of colour. And obviously, as I said, class dynamics come into that. So I think the first thing to understand is, and I'm pretty sure everybody in the room understands this, patriarchy is international. Yeah, it crosses all borders and all the rest of it. And this myth that we've been sold in the West, that as Western women, you know, we're liberated and we should be saving the Egyptian women and the Saudi women. It's like, let's save ourselves first. Let's do the job for ourselves first. We've been spoon-fed this nonsense over hundreds of years, and we are here. And I think it's come as a big shock to a lot of white Western women that they don't have many rights. I think it's come as a genuine shock. Whereas when those of us with those intersectional identities, we understand this because when we, you know, it's our daily life, it's our daily reality. One of the most overused words in the English language is shocking. Everything is shocking. It's like, well, actually, it's not shocking. If you get out of your bubble world and you actually go and listen to those women who no one wants to listen to, guess what? It's not shocking. It's just like a catalogue of endless stories. So that's the first thing. And then I think in terms of the point raised about the contractors, brilliant point. I know a group of female contractors who have been gathering testimony and evidence. They are very scared to come forward. Again, it's that fear. The work is being done. I mean, I have to just tell you this one quick story. I was really stunned by this. As a result of doing the work with Louise and Alexia on NGO Safe Space, a parliamentary whistleblower contacted me. I'm smiling and laughing here because I was like, who is this person? They contacted me based on my tweets and said, I need to come and see you. I was like, I have no idea who this person is. And this person did come and see me. I said, I'm not coming to London. You can come to Oxford, right? Because I thought, I don't know who this person is. They came and we developed a very strong working relationship. And they came and they said that I said, well, what made you want to come to see me? They said, oh, we read your tweets. And I was like, was that it? And they said, yes. Genuinely, they said, we read your tweets and we thought, oh, read some of the stuff you put out there. And we thought, oh, she's interested in hearing us. That's all it took. And then through that parliamentary whistleblower, I heard about these contractors working for different agencies who are gathering the evidence, gathering the information and the data. So it's there, but it's not being used in the way it should. And these government inquiries and these parliamentary inquiries are very limited in scope. And we also need to do this work is deeply political. It's a very, to bear witness, to come and tell your story, to tell your story to an audience, you know, you don't know. These are political acts. And what's happening is across the board, the politics of this violence is, there's an attempt to erase it and just suggest it's all anecdotal. So I totally agree with you. We do need to look at that area of work. But frankly, we've just started. Okay. Well, there's so much work that needs to be done. I'm just going to end on this one point, which is, when are women believed or not believed? Women are never believed. It's just a fact. Women across the board are not believed. But we have to do the groundwork as feminists. We have to do the work. And obviously, when I use the word feminist, that applies to anyone who believes in the, you know, the political, you know, the roots of feminism. And one of the biggest things we need to do is we need to start talking about these things. Stop being silent. Stop being complicit with the silence. Start talking about these things. There are so many women who keep being told, and there's women on this panel too, that you just want to be famous. You want to make a career out of this. This is the thing that's constantly thrown at women and at feminists. We are done with this, right? I think we've just started our work, and we need to get more of us to join forces. And it's really emotionally exhausting work. And the word triggering has been mentioned a few times as well. So we just need to stick together. I know that sounds really simple, but it really is that simple.
Thank you. And thank you to the young lady who spoke about her own experience. And I wanted to also suggest that's part of what, for instance, I keep on, or part of what I like to see, right? Because these systems are so difficult to access, even though I must admit, in 2011, I came back to Oxford and I made a report to the police, and I was really impressed with how they handled it. So I don't know if that was at the Thames Valley police station. Maybe it's not everywhere, but I was really impressed with how they in particular handled it. I remember they videoed my testimony at the time because they were like, so that I don't need to have to constantly repeat it. So I'm also thinking, and like you've rightly said, maybe there are other also issues of she's a hijab wearing woman of color. Maybe that was also part of what the challenge or the obstacles that she experienced. And about not believing women, that's pure gaslighting. All right, and it's very, very political because you see, when they tell us that they don't believe us, we start doubting ourselves. We start thinking, you know, we start disbelieving ourselves, and that's what makes us, you know, crawl under, under a rock somewhere. And okay, I'm not going to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it, and it's very important that we do continue to do so. And I still think that if DFID and the Charity Commission as regulators and all those, these big donor NGOs that we're talking about, if they're really committed to actually make a change, they would, that's part of the advocacy they would do to make it, you know, it's not just to go and let's go save the poor people, you know, in Africa. A lot of feminist theory has actually come from African sisters, for instance. Some of that money, some of that donor money might need to be focused here, you know, in the UK, for instance. How do we make these systems more accessible to women who are experiencing this particular epidemic? Like a South African sister called it sexual terrorism. Because, you know, it's something we live with every day. Okay. And I'm sorry, I don't have any response to the issue about the private sector. Okay. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I'd like to jump on that and echo the kind of shared frustration with this fiction that we're fed is that Western European countries have it all figured out when it comes to police and law enforcement and sexual violence. And it's weird because as somebody who studies training, I don't often find myself advocating it as a solution. However, in this, like Leslie, you mentioned these kind of police techniques like interviewing testimony as opposed to bringing victims to court and so on and so forth, there are strategies that could be done that aren't being put into place. So there is work to be done on the police and law enforcement side. When it comes to changing institutional cultures, I really wish I had an answer for that of how to solve it. And in that, I very much share who asked the question, the concerns around advocating for change on an individual level and advocating for awareness raising, which is unlikely to speak to the institutional power structures that are at work. So I thought instead of answering, I might give an anecdote of something I heard from some NGO workers who were involved in a very prominent organization that works on gender and women's rights that apparently had found out that it had a gender balance problem and needed more men and promptly hired a lot of white men as regional directors. So that kind of brought home the fact of when we need more women, it's we need internship schemes and mentoring and training programs and so forth, that perhaps it's the power structures that need to change.
Okay, I'll start with the private sector question. I think if we look at development in general, but also in terms of social welfare, private sector organizations are relatively newer actors in this sphere. And part of it is coming about because of neoliberal governmentality and the idea that, you know, these actors are more experienced or they're more efficient. And so I think there is an ideological and political baggage that comes with that. But I think there's important questions about, you know, in terms of regulation and codes of conduct, because NGOs for many years have been pushed to have codes of conduct, particularly in the humanitarian sector. But do these private companies have codes of conduct? I doubt that. And also, when we think about regulation, is about how are they then regulated? Because at least what we've seen in this country, big contractors, G4S, A4E, Serco, Capita, They fail again, and yet they continue to get contracts. How does that happen? You know, and I think what we need to look at is, again, who has interest in those companies, and that's, you know, some of the political elites who are making those policy decisions. So I think there is that issue. But I think there's a broader issue about citizenship and rights, because when you begin to outsource so much to these private companies, are they looking at us as citizens who have rights to services and so forth, or customers? You know, and I think there are also issues about whether you can lodge a Freedom of Information Act, because they hide behind saying, you know, this is kind of company secrets. We can't. So there are these issues, and I think this is going to be an area of much more investigation, or at least we need to have that. A brief comment on the police. I think we can never assume that police are neutral actors. I mean, where I've studied, police are often seen as very bribable and corrupt. So, and I think, you know, there's also the element of surveillance and security. People are afraid of reporting, because then that opens up questions about your own actions and who are you, and let's look at your papers and so forth. So I think it was very brave of you to speak, and I'm glad that you did, because it raised we need to, you know, move beyond that kind of secrecy. And an institutional change, I think, from what I've heard in interviews, is that it's very much about leadership. And if the top of the organization doesn't want change, then they begin to, you know, impose particular cultures and behaviors. And I think, you know, where change happens is where senior managers are pushing. At least this is what we've been told, and what I've witnessed as well. So, of course, that's not a magic bullet solution, but I think, you know, that's perhaps something to think about.
Okay, I'm going to be a bad chair, like a bad feminist, and I'm going to take more questions, because if people don't mind, we'll just run over a little bit, because we started a few minutes late. And are you going to kick us out, Zoe, or are we okay for a few minutes extra?
I guess people should feel free to leave if they need to.
Yes. Okay. Not the speakers, though.
Not the speakers, they
But yes, if I could take another round of questions, and then I'll be really cruel to our speakers and only let them speak for like 1 minute maximum each. But yes, oh, we've got a few. Okay, so two there. Three there. You can try and keep them brief, and then some up here and some there. Okay. Yes, keep them brief.
So thank you to all of our speakers. I found everything you said very interesting. And I actually, to kind of back off of the institution question, is a lot of the conversation has also been about culture. And I know that we need an institutional shift in order to ensure that long-term cultural shifts can also occur. But what can we do to actually address the cultural shifts, and not just we need more women in power, because that would be fantastic, but really tangible solutions that can happen as soon as possible, I think.
Great. I like that you're keeping them short, but really okay. Heavy-duty.
Okay, so short.
It's exhausting labor, as Jason said, but
first of all, an amazing panel. Thank you so much. I was working with Oxfam. I just stopped working with them just a month before all of this kind of exploded. So something that happened a decade ago, which is horrible. It's, I mean, Oxfam got everything coming. They completely deserved it. But in the same time, I felt that, I mean, programs closed, programs that we were managing in South Sudan. I was working in South Sudan. And at the same time, I didn't feel a lot of solidarity from other organizations at the same time, or at the exact same time, a UN peacekeeping mission in South Sudan was doing something very, very similar, but nobody heard about it. And, I mean, do you feel that what happened with Oxfam is going to convince other organizations to really report, or just, I mean, shove it under the rug? And another question is, do you feel like, I mean, I agree about the self-regulation, but do you feel that registration could be a solution, for example, which is one of the solutions that they're talking about now? Thank you.
Sorry, just be quite quick. Thank you very much so far. So I work in a large NGO, and that is trying to sort itself out. I won't identify which one. I am one amongst many who's trying to advocate for really strong policies, and particularly around sexual harassment. And people keep coming back to me, and I keep critiquing what they come up with and say, this isn't good enough. And they keep turning around and saying to me, well, show me one that is. Like, what does good look like? And I'm having trouble identifying that. And I don't know where there is a pool that I can go to and say, well, this is what we should be aiming for, because I feel like no one has really put forward or articulated that.
Yeah. Okay, two over here, and then I think we have to stop. And then hopefully there's opportunity at least to get emails.
I also can speak without the microphone, it's fine.
No, it's coming.
Oh, sorry.
Hi. First of all, thank you very much. My question is more towards what Aiko said, but it's to anyone that wants to answer. So we've talked about a lot of good practices and what can we do to prevent it, but ultimately there have been instances where abuse and SEAs have happened, and so accountability comes into place, and that's sort of what I'm very, very interested in knowing. And I'm don't ask you to have the response to UN peacekeeping accountability, because that's too big to address. But what are the steps that we can take to address the fact that the UN is a highly immune organization and impunity is widespread, while there are UN whistleblowers? You know, we have the case of Andreas Compass, but plenty more that, you know, are penalized for their work and their whistleblowing activities. So, just a very small question. It's a small question, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go here, and then I really will let you have that 1 minute. You can do it.
Okay. So I worked in a domestic violence course that was more survivor oriented. It had, like, order protections kind of issued immediately without any evidence from the perpetrator or anything like that. You could wait for court to do that. And a court advocate that went with the survivor to court and kind of just was there for mental health services. You could figure out a way to get out of your house and how to kind of like reset up your life all in court. What is stopping programs like that that seem to have very effective measures of kind of having a more survivor-oriented process from being more mainstream and being more widespread?
The one that you... Yes. I obviously previously overlooked.
Hi, I wanted to ask a quick, hopefully, question about young people, because I think that recognizing that sexual harassment is about imbalances of power recognizes the inherent vulnerability of young people. But young people in development organizations are often on very precarious contracts, consultants and unpaid interns being a huge issue. The thing about these contracts is they're often excluded from formal redress and reporting mechanisms. What I would like to know is how we can ensure that young people are protected, enabled to report, but also how they have their voices heard on these discussions about policy reform. Because my experience in the UN system and in the NGO sector is that as young people, we're just not included, and that's just not good enough, really.
Again, as I said, I'm glad I'm chairing this panel not so well, as you can see by time. But yes, please, if you can just, you know, address as you wish, without taking up too much time, because then I really will be the worst chair ever.
Okay, I'll
I'll just very quickly on that last point. I think as young people or people who have less power within hierarchies, sometimes you might need to step out of that institution to speak about it. And I think this is what we've seen is about creating autonomous spaces from which to speak and to be heard, because otherwise within that organization, there is a big chance that you will be silenced. So I think it is thinking a little bit more creatively and perhaps horizontally. So, but we can talk about that more. I want to pass it on.
Okay. So many what can we do questions.
Yeah.
It depends a little bit on who you are, right? And what, because I found myself we academics, we in NGOs and so forth. So I'll just give you what I see my own work as kind of doing. And one of the things, and it speaks to your point, Liat, as well, about, you know, this happened in Oxfam. Do we think it's just Oxfam? And kind of is to try and disillusion ourselves from the idea that this is so exceptional, and this is one bad apple, and this is the one organization, and to kind of not let that slide when people tell you, oh, we don't need to talk about sexual exploitation and abuse in this country or this organization because they don't have a problem with it, which is something I heard over and over again when I was working. And it may sound cynical, but I've learned to assume that there probably is a problem. We just haven't heard about it yet.
Okay. I'm going to address this question about what does good look like? And I actually discussed this with Steve Dennis, who sued the Norwegian Refugee Council. And like we agreed, there are some organizations that are better than others. But at the end of the day, what does good look like? When your employees are injured, you know, sexual harassment, sexual abuse, it's a workplace safety issue. If and when your employees are injured, just provide them with the best care possible. Nobody would want to go to court if after an injury or an incident, they're being taken care of. And that comes back to what you had earlier said about, you know, the stakeholders here, they're all supposed to be these moral actors, and they're not acting morally. And that's just the truth. And it requires, and this, because of that, we do require a power analysis. This is a power issue that we're talking about. If they're not acting like I said, morally by default, you know, my employee is wounded in the course of work, I'm going to do the best I can, because these are resources that assets I've made an investment in, and I will continue to support them. And I think that should be the way to find what this could look like. It's a beginning.
Thank you so much for being so great.
Okay, so thanks for the hint, Marsha. Okay, so what can we do? So ask questions. Organize, ask questions, open up space, have these types of discussions in your places of work, force those discussions in your places of work. Regarding Oxfam, no, it's not just Oxfam. But, you know, this thing about Oxfam's paid a heavy price. The man at the top has decided when he's going to leave. He was the one who decided when he departs, nobody else. I don't think Oxfam's paid a very heavy price, quite frankly. The other NGOs have kind of sat back and watched because they know the same thing is happening in their organizations. And the whole thing is that bro culture. I wrote about this for The Guardian. There's a bro culture where, you know, you're not going to talk about your bro because then it's going to come back onto you, right? Okay. Other quick things. Okay. The question about, young people. Brilliant question. Again, there's a role for people to play inside the organizations, and there's a role for people to play outside the organizations. And what we need to do is we need to connect these forces. And it's a very, very powerful force, right? So we need to start talking to each other. If you can't do the work inside, there's women here who can, right? So you come to us and you tell us, you know, and we need to kind of work out a strategy, which is who goes to the front, who goes in the middle, and who goes at the back. And the people at the front and the people in the middle and the people in the back, we watch each other and we protect each other. It's as simple as that. It's called organizing, right? We need to get organized. And I feel very hopeful. There's a lot of very positives to take from this. And one of the main ones is that, you know, there's a lot of allies out there. People are silently watching because they don't have the courage yet to say, I support you or I support you. One final thing, Marsha, when Oxfam blew up, I had managers, I worked for Oxfam 5 years, managers I've never spoken to in a long time, contact me, and I found it fascinating, they're all men. Every single one of them said, we didn't know. Every single one, okay? And I just wrote back to them and said, well, then you should have known. And then several months later, one or two of them came back and said, well, yeah, you're right. And then they disappeared again, right? Now it's 8 months on. Who knows? They might surface again at some point, right? But it's a genuine thing. It's like, take responsibility. Do not shift it onto other people. Simple as that.
Oh, I'm so sorry that we've gone over length, but I'm so happy that everyone was able to stay, and I'm sorry for asking that of you, but I think no one will disagree with me when I'm saying this is the best panel I have been to in ages, and I want to thank all of the speakers.
Thanks for organising it as well, Marsha and Zoe. Thank you.